This podcast is intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The FBI had closed in on Jack Barsky. They had watched him for years, tracking his moves and keeping an eye on any suspicious activities. Though he was now living what seemed to be a normal life of an American in the quiet of rural Pennsylvania, the FBI was still not sure if he was an active agent or not. Through a bit of luck, the FBI would land a new home base to surveil Jack that could change everything about the investigation. They became Jack's next-door neighbors.
The houses were not real close in that neighborhood. Jack and Penny were not close to the neighbors that originally were in there, the husband and wife. We never saw them interact with them. So we thought it could work. And for a while, it was a male and female agent that were in there. But mostly, it was just one male agent who was in there. And he wasn't in there all the time. He would come and go at different times. It was someone from our office. The agent who bought the house was from the New York division.
Though he was lead on the case, Joe Riley would roll up his sleeves and get his hands dirty too, by rooting through Jack's garbage.
Oh, that was more than occasionally. That was what is known in the Bureau as a trash cover. Every week he put his trash out, and for the better part of a couple of years, I was going through his trash. After a while, that I wouldn't pick it up. Most of the time, the surveillance team would pick it up after the first few months. I was picking it up at first, but then we had this regular routine where the surveillance unit would pick it up, and they would drop it right outside my garage at my house. They knew where I lived. So when they were going off their shift, they would bring it and drop it at my house, and then I would go through it. And during the winter, it was not a problem, but during the summer, it was not good.
Despite the progress they had made, Riley pushed hard to get an even deeper look into life at the Barskys' home. Retired FBI agent Pete O'Donnell explains.
Back then, you couldn't. You had super locked affidavits saying, this is a spy, this is a Russian trained guy, and we need to, wire his house to get more information so we can assess him to see if he's running other people in this country. And eventually prepare for an interview, which is, the make or break, case at that point. Yeah, you're looking for vulnerabilities. If you can get a wire, if you can get his phone tapped or his house bugged, then you're getting personality assessments.
Joe Riley wanted to bug Jack's house, but the approval process was not an easy one.
I wanted to, and so did my headquarters, wanted to put microphones in the house almost right away, after a few months of the investigation. We put together an affidavit, submitted it to our headquarters, and it had to be approved by the legal section of the FBI, who then took it to the Department of Justice, and their lawyers had to review it, approve of it, and then it would go to the FISA court for authorization to put the mics in the house.
We got on to him, and we verified it. Barsky was the Barsky. We believe Matrokin was saying, we believe this is the guy. Then you develop the FISA warrant. Back then, it was the FISA warrant was extremely difficult to get. That interview is crucial, and you better have done mountains of time of research so you can flip them if you can.
The FBI had monitored Jack for nearly 5 years and still had not moved in for an arrest. Though there were no red flags, they knew he could still be on the move at a moment's notice. Jack's case was the number one espionage case within the FBI, and they needed to take the utmost care, especially knowing they wanted to flip him.
We would want his cooperation. We thought we had, a legitimate illegal here who might be running. Even if he wasn't running people, he might have just had information for the last year or two. We were looking for some good leads, and these guys are like finding unicorns or something. They're very difficult to find. They're so well-trained, so isolated.
It became a real problem, astoundingly to me at the time. I mean, we demonstrated in the affidavit that Jack was an illegal alien operating on behalf of a foreign intelligence service using a false identity. He was trained in Moscow. We had all this information from Matrokin, as well as our own information that we developed here about his phony background and so forth. But the lawyers at the Department of Justice refused to grant our authorization because we could not demonstrate that he was actively spying now. We couldn't show them evidence that he was actually operational. Well, we got caught in a catch-22 because, you know, we tried to tell them. I went down to Washington, D.C. and had a conference with them, with the SAC of the office in Philadelphia. SAC means Special Agent in Charge. He went down with me and we had a conference and explained to them that if our surveillance units followed him to an operational meeting, that he would discover that surveillance, that he was trained to do that. If he discovered the surveillance, he was gone and we'd lose the case. We'd lose him. And we didn't want to do that. So we couldn't provide evidence that he was actually spying, because if we did, we would lose him, if such evidence existed. So we got caught that if we tried to provide that evidence, we wouldn't need the microphones because he'd be gone. So we tried to explain, you know, we had all this other evidence and certainly the Constitution. You know, we want everyone's right to privacy protected, but this is a foreign intelligence agent operating secretly in this country. Certainly he doesn't deserve the protections of the Constitution that you and I deserve to be protected with. And it was finally the director of the FBI interceded and raised hell with them over it, who was Louis Free at the time. But anyway, they finally did approve of it. Was it like a year and a half of wrangling with them? And the FISA court approved it immediately. So we then, on a weekend when they were away, our technical team entered the house, placed microphones in the kitchen and the family room. And then we set up the tapes in the office in Allentown so that we were listening to the conversations.
The whole marriage started on the wrong foot. Think about it. We were companions and lovers, but I married her because I felt sorry for her. And then she got pregnant and, you know, and on. So we skidded into a marriage that should not have been. So I was still sort of trying. I really wanted to make this work. And one day I decided to deploy what I now call the nuclear option to make clear to her that I was really, really, really on her side and not an enemy to be fought. So I don't know the exact words that I used, but I said, hey, listen, I got to tell you something. This is, maybe that proves to you that that I am not your enemy. I used to be a Russian spy. When the Russians wanted me back home, I decided to quit and stay with you and Chelsea. As she thought this through, Penelope got even more upset because now she was smart enough to figure out that if I'm not legal, then she's not legal. So she was now concerned, and there was reason to be concerned, that if I'm ever caught, she'll get kicked out of the country and the kids wind up wardens of the state. And that actually made things worse.
I guess it was 3 or 4 weeks. It wasn't very long that Jack had a conversation with Penelope in the kitchen that revealed everything. Penelope was upset with him because, to be frank, she thought she was marrying an American citizen. She was here illegally. And in marrying an American citizen, she becomes automatically a U.S. citizen. And it turns out this 1 in 100 million shot, she marries a guy who isn't going to get her U.S. citizenship. He's a foreign intelligence agent here illegally.
From Imperative Entertainment, I'm Alden Ehrenreich. This is The Agent.
I was on a one-way street. I needed to go to the United States. She could not be allowed to interfere with that. There was no turning back. it was clear that I was going to become Henry Van Randall.
Soviet troops were all over the place in Afghanistan today.
Neither the American people nor I will support sending an Olympic team to Moscow.
They were afraid that Ronald Reagan might want to accelerate the end of the world.
To ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire, to simply call the arms race a giant misunderstanding.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I created for myself an artificial dual personality. I had two of them. The spy job got in the way of my real job. I knew that the FBI would never find me.
I had a dream one night. I think I need to look for him again. I need to find him.
Chapter 10, No Way Out. Jack had spilled the beans to his wife, telling her everything about his life as an agent for the KGB. And the FBI was listening in on the whole thing.
It came out in detail in this argument. And he was trying to explain to her, you know, the dilemma that he had, that he was in this country and he was stuck now. He wanted to stay with her and with the kids. But if he revealed his identity, he'd be arrested. And, you know, he was in a quandary. He didn't know what to do. And she was upset and he was upset and they were arguing back and forth. But it revealed everything, that he was no longer operational. That was important. He was afraid that they might come after him one day because he had been threatened at the elevated platform in New York City. He was waiting for a train and he was confronted by someone from the KGB, an agent, who basically threatened him. Subsequently, then he moved. He fled from where he was and had moved a couple of times, I think. So he was trying to explain all this to her.
Even more concerning for Penelope was the fact that she had been living in the country as an illegal from the beginning. Now that she discovered she was married to an illegal, what would happen to her and to the children? The marriage had already been on shaky ground and was now made even worse by Jack's admission. Unbeknownst to Jack, the FBI now had him on tape, confirming what Matrokin had written in his notes years earlier.
So when this conversation came up, I immediately relayed it to my headquarters with a request to finally arrest him. I was elated. I wasn't shocked because I expected it. From all the work that we had done, I expected to hear that he was no longer operational. It was no shock to hear that he had been a KGB agent. We knew this. So I was just glad that it came out clearly on this tape and that my headquarters would hear it, that he was no longer operational, and there was no point in continuing this investigation, that we should go and arrest him.
Like any other day, Jack drove to and from the Prudential offices, located 50 miles east from his house. On his way home, right after passing through a toll bridge over the Delaware River, Jack was pulled over by the police.
I worked in Livingston, New Jersey in those days, and the commute by car was about an hour, Route 80. Friday evening was pretty clogged because there was a lot of people going away from New York into the Pocono Mountains and so forth. So I'm driving home pretty much annoyed with, you know, what happened at work. I was always annoyed with what happened at work, you know. The boss is stupid. my colleagues didn't get it. You know, we're spending too much money on useless things. Anyway, so I'm driving home, you know, shaking off what happened during the week and just, you know, looking forward to spending a weekend with the kids. I'm driving west, and as traffic eases, because, you know, all the New Jersey commuters disappeared from the highway, and we speed up, and then I have to cross the Delaware River. That was a bridge with the toll after you cross the bridge. So I drive up and put my coins in, and just as I'm trying to drive off, there's the state trooper in uniform in front of my car and says, "Hello." And so I wind down, and I had a manual control for the windows. And I cranked down the window, and it says, "Yes, sir." It said something like, "Traffic traffic check, routine traffic check. And then he said, would you please step out of the car? And I still didn't put two and two together. And as I'm standing there waiting for this fellow to talk to me, and I sort of sense or maybe even see out of the right side of my eye, somebody coming from behind. And as the man comes closer, looking at him, he looks at me and he flashes a badge. I didn't even look at it. I knew that was trouble. He didn't even have to open his mouth. And then he said, FBI, we would like to talk with you.
Myself and Dave Rowe was the other agent. And when the officer pulled him over, we walked over right behind him and asked Jack to get out of the car, and I told him who we were. And I could tell by the expression on his face that he knew it was all over. Actually, he was a little more calm than I thought he would be. He was more or less resigned to it. It was like he expected it would happen one day, and now it has happened. And we told him he was coming with us.
I was completely unprepared. For many years, forgot that I even used to be an agent. I didn't think about it anymore. I was so in a different world that I never thought the other world would catch up with me. How would they? I was safe. I had lived for 9 years under the documentation that made me Jack Barsky. There was never any problem. There was never any sign that somebody actually was investigating me. And it went like, bam, right? At that moment, it was like a big dam broke and my past, my wicked past, came rushing through and hit me hard. I knew instinctively this was big trouble without thinking it through. So the fellow said, we would like for you to step into their car. My car was parked. As I'm getting into the back seat, there's another agent sitting there, and I saw that he had a gun strapped to his ankle. That was not a good sight for me, but it was clear that things were serious. But here's the bizarre, somewhat curious moment that indicated that I hadn't lost my mind yet, and my mind hadn't gone blank, or somehow my instincts were still working really well. I asked two questions. The first question was, am I under arrest? And Riley, who was driving, turned around and says, no. That's all he said, no. And the second question was, so what took you so long?
He was in the back seat with I think he was with Dave Rowe. When I turned to him and I said, look, this doesn't have to be the worst day of your life. And he immediately sensed then that he had an out, that maybe he could make a deal here. And that's what we wanted. We wanted him to cooperate with us. And in exchange for his cooperation, he could go back to his family and continue to live the life he had been living.
Jack sat in the back seat of the vehicle, pondering his fate. The FBI had questions and took him to a nearby motel.
It's a motel in the village of Water Gap, which is right next to the Delaware Water Gap. We walk in there. They had rented all the rooms in one of the wings and had a guard at each end. I knew how I need to behave. There wasn't never a doubt that I was going to completely cooperate. And I told him that pretty much as we sat down, I told him right off the bat to say, it is in the best interest of myself and my family that I work with you and be as honest and, you know, work with you as best as I can. They led me to the room in the middle of the hallway, and I walk in there, and they had a bunch of props on a bookshelf or something on the wall. It looked like binders that were labeled, and very quickly, as tense as I was, I realized that that stuff was phony, simply because the labels on the binders had bits and pieces of information from my beginning years. There was the name of a lady in West Berlin who I sent letters in secret writing to. My cover name was there, Dieter, and a few others. And I'm thinking to myself, guys, you didn't have to do that. And I thought there may have been an intimidation factor, possibly. And so then we sat down, and they started asking me a whole bunch of questions. Then they allowed me to call the wife to tell her that, hey, honey, I'm coming home, but I'm delayed to work. I'm working late. I already had a sense that they would actually let me go back. I didn't say a word, but in my mind, I says, where the heck am I going to run to? The East Germans forgot about me. I didn't know what they knew or what they didn't know. Certainly the Russians wouldn't want me anymore. And then I had my family here. I was already established here. I had two kids, and I had a house, and I had a career. None of that they really knew for sure, but Riley had a good sense that this is exactly who I was and how I would respond.
We had to decide, come about 11 o'clock that night after we'd been talking with him for 3 hours or more, do we let him go home? I mean, we'd done all this work for all this time. We finally captured a Soviet illegal. Now do we let him go home? But I had reached a point where I thought we could do that. You can imagine how embarrassing that would be for the FBI had he disappeared. That would have been disaster. But I felt, well, we had a couple things going for us. Number one, we had the house next door. And we had several guys in the house next door with eyes on his house. There was no way he could leave that house in a vehicle or any other way without agents knowing it. And I wanted to convince him of the fact that we would know if he tried to flee. But I didn't tell him anything about the house next door, but I told him we would know if he tried to flee. And he said, no, he said, I'm not going to. He said, I'm going to cooperate. And from our conversation with him, just in that 3 or 4 hours, I became convinced that he was going to cooperate with us completely. And we were a little apprehensive, all of us, about letting him go home. But we talked about it and decided, because we had the house next door, we had eyes on his house, that we'd be safe.
Afford Anything talks about how to avoid common pitfalls, how to refine your mental models, and how to think about how to think.
Paula, while certainly you can mess up on $1 million a year, it is far less likely than it is on $30,000 a year.
Right.
I would meet wonderful people that were struggling with a budget that was super tight. It was 100%. You need to make more money.
Make smarter choices and build a better life.
Afford Anything, wherever you listen.
That evening, they took me back to my car because the car was parked by the bridge. And from there, I drove home. Don't talk to your wife. Just keep it secret. I don't recall the arrangements that we made for the next meeting. There was some hope because of what Riley said. This may not be the worst day of your life. But they didn't go any further. They wound up probably knowing more than what I remember now. From childhood on, every little piece. And I understand this in hindsight. This is valuable for counterintelligence because I was one of the best trained. I was one of the elite. It is what it is. I'm not bragging. I was one of the elite. They knew it. So they were trying to find out what kind of a person the Soviets would select. To what extent that's useful and valuable, I don't know, but clearly the FBI did. I had this endless loop in my head into what's going to happen, what's going to happen. You know, I was worried about the kids. I was worried about the wife. I wasn't so much worried about me because the possibility of going to jail had always been with me. Clearly, I was also worried about me. I'm not saying I wasn't, but, you know, it was primarily the kids. It was the growing season for sure, and I would be outside mowing the lawn and doing all kinds of work where your mind is not occupied. And that loop kept on going and going. And I can't tell you exactly how long that happened, maybe 3 to 4 weeks. And the sequence is also not quite clear. I had to take a lie detector test. And I believe after I passed the test, they told me, we have decided, the American government has decided that you can stay in this country. You continue doing what you're doing work-wise, and there is a path to citizenship for you down the road. Boom. I was home free. I was an unusual case. Typically, when you deal with defectors, you give them another ID. You start them fresh. They might wind up in the witness protection program and so forth. Well, in my case, they decided And I was very grateful for that. They decided not to disrupt the family, not to give me another ID, because that would have meant my career. And it would have cost the American government quite a bit of money, right? Because I couldn't use the past anymore. My second career would have been blocked. Maybe I would have started as a waiter someplace again, started fresh at the bottom. And it would have been damaging to the family. It would have been damaging to myself. And you really don't want one of those defectors, ex-agents, to go bad.
Not long after the weekly sessions the FBI held with Jack, Joe Riley and Dave Rowe went to his house and met Penelope to tell her about Jack's interrogation.
She was, if memory serves, again, she was not shocked. She was not surprised that this happened, because Jack had told her of his situation. I explained to her the situation, that Jack was going to cooperate with us, he was going to work with us, and that he was going to continue to live the life that he had been living here. She was surprised that we were going to let him continue living his life. But of course, she didn't understand our motives, you know, in terms of having him work with us. She didn't fully understand that. And we, of course, couldn't tell her a lot of the details about this case, you know, so.
The lingering concern Penelope had of being deported and potentially losing her children had hung over her since that day that the couple had argued in the kitchen, all with the FBI listening in.
It's something we never thought of or considered. We would have had we reached that point, but we didn't think we were going to have that problem, because we thought Jack was going to cooperate, that he was going to go back living his life. So we didn't anticipate that we would have that problem. Had we had it, then we would have had to deal with it somehow. But she would not have been deported right away. She had those two kids. She had been living here. She would have been able to stay here indefinitely, really. We told him that we were going to continue our debriefing of him over a period of months, and we did. But he had to go back to work. I believe he went back to work that Monday. And then we would set up a debriefing schedule, some at night, some on weekends. There's the personal side. You know, Jack and I had lunch together many times. We talked about many subjects. I never got the impression that he was deceptive. And when you're involved in law enforcement, whether it's local or federal, you get tuned in over time with your experience to people who are deceptive in their conversations with you. I mean, not that you're 100% accurate in that regard. In fact, I can remember one time talking with a guy who was basically a sociopath. And he was a great liar, and he could fool me or anyone. But most of the time, you get pretty good at determining who's telling you the truth and who isn't, who's shading the truth one way or another. And I just never got that impression with Jack.
The briefings were extensive and crossed over into a mix of key intelligence units in the U.S. government. They wanted to know everything about Jack and his experiences as an agent.
There were people from NSA that came to debrief him because of his communication with KGB Central and how he did it and the codes that were used and so forth. That was important that NSA knew what was going on there. And the CIA wanted to debrief him. We went down to Washington a couple times for meetings. So it was a long period. He took us to a couple of other drop sites, that one in Staten Island, where money was left for him. But it appears some kids playing in the woods around there may have discovered it. But we never found the money or the drop.
Though Jack had shared everything he knew, there was still one person who was unaware of her father's secret life. His daughter, Chelsea.
I'm sitting in the living room in the house in Pennsylvania. I'm watching an NBA game, Michael Jordan playing. And she's sitting next to me. She was probably 11 years old, and she was still sucking her thumb like this. And she's looking at this, and she said, "What's that?" I said, "That's basketball. I want to play that." That's very similar to me thinking when I was 18, I want to go play basketball. She was 11, and she never looked back. Installed a hoop. We started shooting hoops. Then she joined a rec team. The first time she was on the floor in a game, she was running towards their own basket and didn't pay attention. She got hit in the head with a ball. But within 2 months, she had become the go-to player. She had this one move. She would just dribble down the side, turn around, and shoot it. It was my hobby. It was what I did during my spare time. Now, guys play golf. I did basketball. Made profiles for the kids with pictures and everything down the road when we came to college recruiting.
Chelsea had achieved everything in basketball that her father had not been able to when his time was cut short living in Germany. Chelsea had real talent, and scouts were at many of her high school games.
I was getting recruited by a lot of schools, a lot of Division I basketball schools. I had a lot of offers. My first offer was like my sophomore year in high school by a Division II school. So I decided I was going to wait it out, because if I had a Division II offer by the time I was a sophomore in high school, I was pretty sure I can get to Division I.
Chelsea did receive a Division I scholarship from St. Francis, located in Western Pennsylvania.
And so I'm on the way to St. Francis with my dad in the car, and we're just talking, and he decides to start telling me the story. It just came out. And I think he opened up with, like, you're the reason that I'm still here today. And I was like, okay. I didn't know what he was about to tell me. Then he basically stated, you know, I was a KGB spy. Wow, okay, that kind of already explains a lot of things. And then he told me the story. Not in its entirety, but I mean, because you cannot tell this story in 4.5 hours. But I just remember sitting there just listening. And I could not get this thought out of my head that he's only alive or just only here in my life because I existed. I couldn't figure that out. He told me, this is what I did for my career. This is not my real name. My real name is Albert Dietrich, and this is where I'm from, and this is what I did. And so I asked him some questions, and he answered them. But it was like a summary, a 4-hour summary. It wasn't the story in its entirety. He didn't tell me in detail. He just said that he was called to go back. It was very brief. My cover was blown, and they called me to go back, but I decided to risk it and stay. That's what he said. He didn't give me details. He basically told me more of the truth about his childhood. So, like, the truth about his parents, instead of the story that he had told me. The languages he can speak and the time he trained in Moscow, all of his travels. So he was telling me about those things. He didn't tell me details about how he met my mom, but I already knew that. And my parents didn't know that I knew. I kind of figured it out. I found letters. I was hunting for stuff, right? Because my dad told me when I was 12, 13, like, I have something to tell you when you're old enough to understand. And so I was digging, and I found some things, but it didn't tie it back to the spy stuff, so I didn't know. So that makes sense then, because he was like, the FBI, they caught up with me when we were living in Pennsylvania, but he still didn't know that the house next door was occupied by agents at that time. He had no idea. That came later. My dad had never not been there. I did not receive this story and think that my life was in danger. I didn't think that something would happen to him, that he would go away, because he had already told me the FBI is letting us stay here, is letting me stay here and letting me become a citizen at some point. I didn't think that was even something I needed to ask. I just assumed that nothing was really going to change. I think I did ask him, you know, is it safe for me to talk about this? And he said, you probably shouldn't. And I did anyways. I told my friends, because I was like, I don't know how to process this. Nobody else I know has a dad that was a spy. I told friends and they were like, yeah, whatever.
And Jack also told his daughter why he stayed in America.
I think the exact words he said was, I stayed here because of you, baby. He always calls me baby. You were the reason that I stayed. You're the reason that I'm here, the reason I'm alive. But he didn't go into the emotional reason behind it. Most of our conversations throughout my childhood up to my early 20s. There was not a lot of emotional stuff coming out of him. It was very matter of fact and a lot of life lessons coming from him, a lot of hard life lessons. The emotional connection, me towards my dad, is the strongest. I think he has a strong emotional connection too, but he hides it, and he had to. You cannot show your emotions as a spy. And so now that I hear this story on my way to college, everything makes sense. That explains why he is the way he is. I know he loves me, so I don't need him to tell me that it's okay, because I know it's okay, because he otherwise wouldn't have been able to tell me. For as long as I can remember, we would never have a conversation where like he would get emotional, like teary-eyed or anything. Never.
While Chelsea was away at college, Jack and Penelope's marriage finally fell apart.
I go to college, and then by the time I was a junior, my parents were starting to go through the divorce process. My dad moved out of the house, per my advice. And so when he did that, he took my parrot with him. I would go visit him. There's this one night we're watching basketball in this townhouse he was renting. He's facing the TV, watching the game. He's looking dead on at the TV and he goes, "Did I ever tell you that you have a brother?" "What do you mean? I have Jesse." "No, I mean a German brother."
Next time on The Agent.
This was one of those secrets that eventually wanted out. I had not expected that she would latch onto that.
I had given up because I was like, I don't really know if there's going to be a possibility of finding him. I had a dream one night. I think I need to look for him again. I need to find him.
The Agent is a production of Imperative Entertainment in association with Windjoy and is created, written, produced, and edited by Jason Hoke. Narration by Alden Ehrenreich. Executive producers are Jason Hoke, Jack Barsky, and Alden Ehrenreich. Sound engineering and additional editing by Shane Freeman. Our original score by Joshua Klebe. Cover art and design by Gina Sullivan. If you'd like to learn more about this story, make sure to read Deep Undercover, My Secret Life and Entangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America by Jack Barsky. Have questions? Email us at podcasts@imperativeentertainment.com. If you love this show, tell your friends and leave us a positive review. Thanks again for listening.
Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker.
Although I didn't really work with her a lot.
But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a 3-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.